Hey, this is Mark, and I'm back again with another great episode of Finding Your Summit. And this week we have Mike Hamill. And Mike is a guy I met about 7 years ago when I went over to Russia to climb a mountain called Mount Elbrus. And Mount Elbrus is is Europe's highest peak. And, he's really been there for me in terms of being my leader, my guide up some of these different mountains I've been on, and really providing the leadership and guidance on what I need to do to really complete the seven summits around the world. And this last year, he decided to take a big risk. And after working for 20 years for the exact same mountaineering guiding company, he decided to leave and start his own gig called Climbing the Seven Summits. Figure that. So this last March, April, May, he had his first guided climb on Everest. And all the guys, some of which are my friends, were on that climb. They all summited. So it was a big rousing success for him. And now he continues to expand his offering of taking people up very safely around the world on these different crazy mountains guys like me love to go on. So we get more with Mike a little bit later. But as always, please go in to rate and review on iTunes. It really helps in giving us a lift. And we are, of course, sponsored by violetsorblueskincare.com. It's great stuff. It's all natural. Cynthia Besteman, she went through her own adversity and started this all natural skincare line. And if you want to find out anything about what's going on with me, things are always changing, you can go to my website at www.markpattisonnfl.com. And I've got an e-learning course that's coming out. I have a book that's coming out. And I'm headed down to Vincent, Antarctica, not with Mike, but with another group. I'll have to do with timing. I look forward to doing that. So you'll be able to track and trace me through this new Garmin app that I'm integrating with my website. So that would be very cool to see and watch. So on that note, let's go talk to Mike. Here we go. Hey, it's Mark Pattison, and I am back again with another epic episode of Finding Your Summit. And in this case, it might even be Finding Your Way. Today, I've got Michael Hamill. I actually call him Mike Hamill. But he is a world-class mountaineer. I've been on several expeditions with him. Mike, how you doing?
Good, Mark. Glad to be here.
Yeah, you know, I've been trying to like nail you down now for quite some time, and part of it is logistics, part of it is timing, like all things. But today I know you're down in Sydney. I think you now call that place home.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've been down in Sydney, Australia for year and a half now, but it's good to finally connect with you. You know, my lifestyle has me on the road good 8 to 10 months a year, so I'm always coming and going, hard to nail me down, but good to finally connect.
Well, it's interesting because I know that you originally originated from Vermont or someplace on the East Coast, Upper East Coast there, and you met a wonderful woman. I've met her, and one thing led to another, and now you find yourself in Sydney, and just such a great part of the world. I've been there several times.
It is. You know, there's not much for mountains here. If you're a big mountain climber like myself, that's not a big draw, but man, it's an incredible place. Weather's phenomenal. It's nice to have a little beach time when I'm out of the mountains as well. So it's a nice offset to my mountain lifestyle.
Well, as we talked about prior to going live on the pod, I do live in Sun Valley, Idaho, but today I am beaming from Los Angeles, California. It's nice and warm out here. So similar weather type temps here near the beach, and it's just great to have kind of that mountain beach lifestyle, and you certainly are living that. So what I want to do is I want to backtrack just a little bit because you've just been on this amazing, you know, journey for a long time, and I think a lot of this theme, this podcast to me, is really about finding your purpose. I mean, we call it finding your summit, but I think your summit literally has been on the summit. And it's such a easy, you get sucked into the corporate world and you feel the world of obligation and you just didn't get caught up in that. So let's talk about where you originally found your love of climbing and being in the mountains.
So growing up on the East Coast, I spent a lot of time in the mountains. I really cut my teeth on the steep rock climbing and ice climbing of the White Mountains and the Adirondacks. And, you know, I think I was just lucky because I found my passion early, and that was climbing. You know, I was a big competitive Nordic skier through university, and that was kind of my passion when I was younger. But once I got turned on to climbing, it was all I could think about. I just wanted to go explore the world and, you know, climb these mighty peaks. Couldn't get enough reading about the mountains and watching movies about the mountains. So I think in a lot of ways, I was just lucky to find my passion early. And really, as soon as I got out of university, I took a job as a mountain guide, and one thing led to another. And here I am 20 years later, still a mountain guide, loving the work I do and loving my lifestyle. It has its challenges at times, and certainly not easy to climb up Mount Everest every year, but it's what I love to do and I'm passionate about it. So I consider myself really lucky.
Well, yeah, now look at, I can certainly understand that. You started a long time ago. I took a little bit different path, but I did find my way into the mountains, and that's really how I found you. I know that you worked for many, many years for a company called IMG, International Mountain Guides. We both have common friends over there. You worked for them, so you probably know all the folks. But, you know, originally when I was drawing this whole thing up with Phil Ursler, I said, look, I'm really interested in going with somebody who really understands me, understands my vision, where I'm going. And he said, look, I've got two guys I think that would be fantastic for you to be with. And I can't remember the one guy, but the other guy was you. And I think it was on my first year, I went down to, Tanzania, climbed Kilimanjaro. I came back, and the following year, I found my way in Russia, climb Mount Elbrus. And, you know, that each one of these things, as you know, you really find your way and find yourself and find your weak spots. And, you know, certainly there was a number that I had in my game that need to be honed, from nutrition just to what you put on and all those things. And, you know, from day one, you've really been a great mentor to me in terms of really helping educate me in the right way to get up the mountain in a safe way and back down. You know, that's what makes you who you are, and one of the reasons why you've been able to thrive.
Yeah, you know, there is certainly a learning curve to this whole climbing thing. A lot of it is getting your systems down, as you mentioned, getting the nutrition down. And I think it was just serendipitous that you and I connected early on in your climbing career, and we could kind of work our way up through some of these peaks together.
Yeah. So, you know, it was interesting because I'd never been to, I mean, I've been to Europe several times, but certainly never going to Russia. And I think one of the things that I finally was the tipping point for me is, you know, for years and years and years when my kids were younger, I was always doing the typical vacations, Hawaii or Mexico, and they're all good. I mean, it's fantastic. And you go to the big typical resort and with the big pool and all those things. And that's what you do when you have younger kids, right?
Yeah.
And I just got to that point where it was kind of the tipping point for me where I didn't want to go down that path anymore. And I really wanted to get after this thing called adventure travel. And so when else, I mean, I've said this several times to many different people about, it's just not about climbing the seven summits. It's so much of it for me has really been the journey. And you hear that it's kind of a corny line. It's not about the destination. Yeah. It's the journey, but it really is that. I mean, when else would I be in Moscow? When else would I be in Leningrad, right? St. Petersburg.
Yeah.
Some of those small towns, I can't even remember what they're called, but you know, the planes, trains, and automobiles that you and I took to get down to that ultimate launching point before Mount Elbrus and the training ground. I mean, you just never do that. And then all these wonderful people that you meet along the way, and some of the people too aren't wonderful. You know, they're not not necessarily not wonderful, but they're just, they have no business being in the mountains. But that's just all part of the game and what you learn. But it's really been an amazing journey.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that's one of the beautiful things of the seven summits. Is the fact that it challenges you to travel to each of the seven continents. I mean, like you say, why else would you go to Antarctica? I mean, maybe you'd go see the puffins on the coastline or something, but that's one of the beauties of the Seven Summits. It forces you to travel. It puts you out of your comfort zone. And that's one of the things I've loved about it. It's been a great education for me. So yeah, it's pretty cool.
You know, so my third mountain, I actually went down to Australia and climbed in the Snowy Mountains. You mentioned that, you know, obviously Australia is not the highest of the peaks. There's certainly not that, but Mount Kosciuszko.
Yeah.
And actually, I like to call that the Fun Seven. I mean, I went down there, and it was a transitional point in time in my life, but I flew into Sydney, where you're at today, and then made my way to the Snowy Mountains, climbed Mount Kosciuszko, and then exited the other direction and flew out of Melbourne and really got to see the country, got to see, you know, the wonderful people out there and interact. And, you know, that's not a mountain you necessarily, certainly during their summer, you need to have a mountain guide, but it was just a ton of fun to get there. But the next year, let me see, number four for me, we found our way down in Argentina, and we were climbing Aconcagua. And it's interesting, too, Mike. I'm not sure if you agree with this, but it seems like unless you go climb that mountain, nobody can say the word Aconcagua.
Exactly. Certainly not Europeans. They all seem to struggle with it.
No, it's so funny. But, you know, I think that was another one that's, you know, that's another mountain that's just under 23,000 feet. And I mean, look, I will always have the utmost respect for you. You've done the Seven Summits something five or six times.
Yeah.
You know, made the circuit, which is incredible. But on that particular day, man, you had some kind of virus and you just could not kick it at that 19,500 foot camp.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. That was the first time that ever happened to me that I wasn't able to summit on a guided climb. In the past, I've been sick, and you know, I've been able to muster through and get to the top and kind of recover when I get down. But that was definitely an eye opener for me. And I guess it just goes to show that these mountains are the great equalizer, and they're all incredibly difficult. Certainly Aconcagua, nearly 23,000 feet in Argentina, is a pretty difficult peak. And, you know, you just, everyone has good days and bad days. And that was certainly an off day for me. And it's unfortunate that it was a summit day, but, definitely was humbling and, an eye opener for me.
Yeah. And as you can tell, I'm kind of doing the chronology of you and I climbing together, and then we're going to break off here and go in a different direction. But the following year after that, you and I, this is 2 years ago now, we were in Alaska. We were trying to climb North America's highest peak, that peak that would be Denali, 20,320. We just got stuck at 14,200. And, you know, up top, I remember there was that lenticular cloud. And it was something like minus 60 or some crazy number. And I actually still have a screenshot that I took that showed a superstorm coming behind that at minus 78. And you're like, guys, you know, we're not doing this. So as always, I think what a lot of people don't understand is that it's almost like a military command where you really have to have top down. And you if you're the lead guy, which you were, it's just whatever you say ultimately goes, period.
Yeah, and that was certainly a humbling experience as well. You know, I think a lot of people sign up for some of these climbs or maybe look at the Seven Summits and think, well, I can just jump on with a guide and everything's going to be fine. But there we were sitting at 14,000 feet. It was minus 40 degrees without wind chill. It was probably, you know, minus 80, minus 90 with wind chill on the summit. And you've got a worse storm coming our way. I mean, that's pretty serious, dangerous conditions. And I think we made the right call there, bailing out, because those that didn't ended up sitting on the mountain for another 7 to 10 days. But, you know, very humbling. And it makes you realize that mountains are a dangerous place. Certainly Denali, for sure.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people say too, and well, there's two things that stand out about Denali. Number one is that as we were going up together 2 years ago, you were saying, look, I have been all over the world. I've climbed every single major peak that is out there. And certainly you've been on Everest a number of times, been in the Himalaya. But you're talking about how the whole Alaskan mountain range to you is the most majestic that's out there. Denali being the most majestic mountain range that is out there, and that tops the Himalaya.
Yeah, I believe that to be true. For me, it's the highlight of my year getting up to the Alaska range. It's like It's like being in an ice age. Absolutely stunning. So far north that the lighting is just so special. And I love that place, but it makes you work for it. That's definitely the hardest climb. Well, you know, physically, it's the hardest climb on the seven summits. You're carrying 120 pounds of gear when you leave base camp. And Everest is, you know, you struggle a lot with the altitude, but you're only carrying a day pack of 15 pounds. So it's a tough one. But I always say that I keep going back to Denali because I need to prove to myself I'm still a man. I mean, that's that's a real climb. And, you know, the fact that you had to go back and do it again, I'm glad you got up the second time. But we saw the fire and fury on the first round up there.
Yeah, no question. You know, I was very fortunate to summit on June 7th, and the guy that was Victor, who is our guide, is a guy that had been up there, I think, seven times and made it four. And of the seven times that he had been up there and guided, it was the fastest. And we just had spectacular weather the entire time. And I think there's maybe 2 days later, there's 9 feet of snow. And so, you know, to your point, things can turn in a minute, and you got to be prepared and make the right decisions and go back and just, like, it's just not meant to be.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's one peak you never know. I mean, I remember sitting at high camp with Victor for a week. We got 3 or 4 feet of snow and trying to get to a 20,000 foot summit in 4 feet of fresh snow is probably the hardest day I've ever had in the mountains. So you just never know with that peak.
You know, actually, your name came up when now that you mentioned that, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but you guys were at high camp up at 17,000, and you guys were going to go and, like, blast a trail across the Audubon, which is super dangerous, and just, like, incredible that you guys would even think about doing that.
It was a hard day. I remember we were kind of swapping leads. Victor would be out front for a bit. I'd be out front for a bit. And I mean, at that altitude, walking up steep slopes like that, through breaking trail through 3 or 4 feet of snow, it's incredibly hard. And the fact that we were able to pull off the summit is pretty amazing. But it was a long tough day.
No, incredible. But anyways, you know, as we both have talked about, I don't know if you're going to go back. I have no desire to go back and take that on again. I mean, it was just a mother beast. And, you know, if the weather wasn't so unpredictable and I'm the one paying for it, you know, maybe that would be a different answer, but it's not. And so I'm just like, check, and I'm not going back. So onward and upward. So many years ago, you wrote a book called Climbing the Seven Summits. And I know that not from reading about it, but because I actually have that book and part of my collection that's at my place in Sun Valley, Idaho. And you were nice enough to autograph it for me and send that. But it really details all the different all the different mountains that are out there. So I don't know if you were like, this was something that you were thinking about of the future, or it's just kind of the way it played out. But you've now transitioned from being a worker bee and guide for IMG and the outfitter up in Alaska on Denali to now actually running your own outfitting guide service called with the same name, Climbing the Seven Summits. So let's go to the book first. Is that something that you were thinking about, you know, within the future at the time, or it just made sense to write a book about the mountains that you're climbing?
Originally I wasn't thinking about writing a book. The seven summits were something that called to me. So I pretty much ended up climbing the seven summits on my own. And back when I did it, you know, 15, 20 years ago, there wasn't much information out there on the seven summits. So climbs like doing Elbrus in Russia on my own, where no one speaks English, they were super difficult. It was really hard to find information online, trying to communicate with Russians with broken English. It didn't work well. And a lot of the other peaks were the same way. So I just felt like there needed to be a resource out there for people like me that were trying to accomplish the seven summits. So it made perfect sense to write a book on it and kind of, accumulate all the knowledge I had learned over the years guiding and climbing the seven summits in one place. And I presented it to the Mountaineers Books in Seattle, and they loved the idea, and kind of the rest is history there.
Well, for anybody that is interested in that book, it's fantastic, and it's got just a boatload of fantastic pictures that really describe being kind of the who, what, where, how. And like you said, it's kind of a jack of all trades. Here's, if you're going to go take this stuff on, this is the way you go about doing it, with recommendations on outfitters. And, you know, so it's just a great resource. Where can people find that book, by the way?
I've got it on my website, climbingthe7summits.com. The top of the page, you'll see the book tab there. It's also on Amazon as well.
Yeah, that's awesome. Okay, so we're going to put that in the show notes a little bit later. I want to talk about Everest. As you know, I'm headed there in March of 2020. And I know that this last year was your first. So there's two parts of this. One, you've been on top of Everest 5 times. The second thing is last year was your first expedition as your own company. And I think some of the guys I actually have climbed with, but everybody made it to the top safely and back down.
Absolutely. 100% success last spring, which was pretty cool for my first. It was my 10th expedition to Mount Everest, but it was the first one through my company, Climbing the Seven Summits. So to have everyone stand on top of both Everest and Lhotse was just such an amazing feeling for me. It made me feel like I was doing the right thing. Like, we had a great program in place, and you know, that was a great launching pad for me, for the company. And I've got a ton of interest for Everest this coming spring, I think, because everything went so smoothly last year. So it was great to be able to climb with a bunch of good friends, clients last year, and just see everyone be successful.
Yeah. So let's talk about Lhotse and the kind of the combo. Is that an option, or is that, it's just part of the thing that you offer that's different from everybody else, or does everybody do that combo trip?
It's very rare to do that combo trip. It's getting less rare. I think probably 10 to 15 guided clients have accomplished it now, but it's absolutely a huge feat. I mean, to climb Everest alone is a massive feat, but then to come back down to the South Col after Everest, get a few hours of rest on oxygen, and then head back out to climb the fourth tallest peak on Earth, Lhotse, within 24 hours is just, it's a very hard thing to do. Let's put it that way. So it's becoming more common, but it's only been done by a handful of people in history. And if someone feels confident and competent at altitude and is going to tackle Everest, I think that's a great challenge.
So if I get this right, so what you offer with climbingthe7summits.com is a guided a guided expedition up to the top of Everest and back. And if somebody wants to also take on Lhotse, then you package that together and you make that happen.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's a separate permit fee for Lhotse, but really the costs associated with Lhotse, because it's not Everest, everyone wants to climb Everest, so the permit fees there are much higher. To tag on Lhotse is not that much more expensive. And then, you know, you really put yourself in the record books summiting 2 8,000-meter peaks in 24 hours, which is a pretty cool thing to do.
Yeah, I think Matt Wood accomplished that, correct?
He did. He did, yeah. And he was, I think, as I mentioned, maybe 10 guided clients have done it and maybe 20, 25 people in history. So he's in the record books for that now.
Wow, that's incredible. So, you know, kudos certainly to Matt if you're listening. Yeah. That's amazing. So let's talk about Everest just in general. I mean, that mountain has brought a lot of controversy. You were involved. I want to talk to you more about this. In 2008, there was a reality documentary that you were involved in. What exactly did you do with that film? This podcast is brought to you by Laird Superfoods. Let me tell you, these creamers are so amazing. They're super tasty, super delicious. And what they are is whole natural food ingredients mixed into these creamers. And I'm telling you, when you put this stuff into your drink, this powder substance, it is amazing. And their whole tagline is all about fueling your journey. You cannot go and actually power your way up a mountain, be in the pool, ride a big wave, unless you're properly fueled. And these guys are doing it all the right way. So where can you find this? At LairdSuperfood.com. And here's the kicker. If you use the code name MarkP20, that's MarkP20, you're going to get 20% off on your first order. So check it out, LairdSuperfood.com. Tell you more about this. In 2008, there was a reality documentary that you were involved in. What exactly did you do with that film?
That TV show, Everest Beyond the Limits, basically I was hired as both talent and a filmer. So I was carrying a camera the whole time. I had this massive 5-pound battery in my pack, and I had this camera strapped to my head. And so I was filming the whole way, which is pretty cool. It was a new experience for me, but I was also talent. So they were documenting me in the program. So they followed my climb, with my clients, and, basically just kind of showed, what an Everest expedition is like.
Yeah, that's great. I actually remember watching, maybe I downloaded season 1 and 2 or something that is on there, and I don't remember your part in that. But then again, that was a couple of years ago, and I can't really remember anything other than, there was a lot of controversy and people bickering and arguing and trying to get up the face and altitude sickness and all kinds of stuff. So, I know, and my date is escaping me this exact moment. I remember this clearly because you and I were texting back and forth, and I was concerned for your safety, but you were over there when that massive earthquake hit and all that pitch came flying down the hill and like took out Camp 1. You may have been at Camp 2 at the time when all that happened.
I was at base camp. There were actually 2 avalanches consecutive years in 2014 and 2015, I believe. 2014, there was a massive avalanche that came off in the ice fall that that killed 16 Sherpa.
Yeah,
that was obviously a huge tragedy, and I was there for that year and helping with the rescue of the Sherpa and the bodies and all that. But I think the incident that you're referring to was in 2015 when there was a massive earthquake in Nepal, and that earthquake triggered an avalanche that came down and took out almost all of base camp and killed 19 people almost instantly. I was there for that as well. And it's interesting. I went to a film festival the other day, and I saw some footage of someone capturing that moment, the avalanche hitting camp. And it was the first time I had seen that footage since actually being in that situation. And it just brought back so many memories and feelings from that. It was a very intense, situation to be a part of. And, you know, I was lucky to survive. I just got hit by the blast. No rocks came through our camp. But immediately I knew that other people had been killed or injured. So, myself and a couple other guides, we went out and started trying to pick up the pieces, help as many people as we could, and, you know, kind of triage the situation and really dealing with the rescue and repatriation of bodies, but also trying to keep people alive. And, you know, it was just a good 2-3 days of setting up these makeshift hospitals in our camp and just trying to keep people alive. It was an incredibly desperate situation at base camp. I believe 10,000 people across Nepal died from that earthquake. So it was a huge, tragedy. But I was at base camp for that. That's where we got hit the worst. There were some people on the mountain at Camp 1 and Camp 2. And surprisingly, that's a very tight valley up there. So my first concern was that they had gotten hit by avalanches up there. They were actually fine. And we were able to get helicopters up there and get them out of there. And everyone was okay up there. It was us at base camp that got hit the hardest.
So the reason why you had helicopters is because the Kumba ice fields had completely shifted, or why couldn't they just climb back down?
Exactly. The earthquake had changed the route. All the fixed lines through the Khumbu icefall had fallen down. So there was no way for people to move up and down the mountain. So the only way to get people out of there was to fly helicopters up, pick them up and bring them down, which is pretty dangerous. The pilots, the heli pilots over there, are some of the best in the world, and they felt comfortable with it. It was certainly safer than having the climbers come back, try and come back down through the Khumbu Icefall. So we flew probably 50 helicopter trips up the mountain to get people out of there, and everyone was fine. They were very shaken up, as you can imagine, being trapped on Mount Everest, but everyone was fine.
So I can't begin to imagine. Okay, so there's two levels of this, right? So you're at base camp, and it's like you said, triage situation, and it's awful. And yep. You're trying to make the best of everything. And at the same time, people are now trying to like, okay, somehow or another, I have to get back to Kathmandu and get out of there. But that had been destroyed as well, right? So it's just the entire yep. infrastructure was a wreck. And yep. you're trying to figure out how to, you know, survive, get back. And it's not like, you know, across the valley. I mean, it's a significant trek to get back, right, to probably Lhotka, and then from there you got to fly out to Kathmandu, and then from Kathmandu back yeah. to the States or wherever you're yeah. going to.
Yeah, the entire country was shut down. As I mentioned, 10,000 people were killed from this earthquake across Nepal. So everything was shut down. The airports were shut down. So basically what we did was, you know, we kind of stayed at base camp for a few days and dealt with the rescue and repatriation of bodies there. And then we headed down the valley, but all the tea houses were destroyed. We didn't feel comfortable staying in them because they were, you know, walls had fallen down and they were unsafe to go inside of. So we kind of slowly camped our way down the valley, basically buying time for the airports to reopen so that we could even consider going home. So it was this very strange feeling of almost being in purgatory. Like you couldn't climb the mountain, but you couldn't go home either. So we basically took our time heading down the valley. We went to Fortse, where a lot of our Sherpa live, and we tried to do what we could to help them rebuild some of their tea houses and houses. So, you know, we tried to make use of that time, but it was a pretty emotional time. We'd watched friends and relatives of some of our Sherpa die, and we had flown their bodies out of there, and then we're just kind of stuck in this purgatory. So it was a really strange time.
Yeah. So how long did you end up being in the country beyond what you would have normally been there?
Well, that was early on in the expedition, and obviously we cut the expedition short. So we went home. We flew home probably a month before we would have yeah. had we kept climbing, but we were probably another 2 weeks after the accident before we could even get on a flight back home out of Nepal.
Yeah, man, that's – well, look at, you know – knock on wood, you're still here today. And yeah. I a lot of times when people look at me who don't know anything about mountain climbing, we start talking about, you know, safety and they fear for me and all this stuff. And I really believe it's either bad luck or stupidity. And that what you just talked about right yeah. now is bad luck. You know, you yeah. have once in every 100 years, you've got an earthquake that comes down or that just rattles the entire country. And then you have these avalanches that just happen to come in position where they're taking out base camp. And then the other part of that is stupidity. I yeah. look at into thin air, that whole mess that happened in 1996. And there's yeah. just one thing after the other in terms of what the guides did and yeah. what the people did and trying to climb in a superstorm and go beyond what they should yeah. have been and blah, blah, blah. And yeah. you know, bad things happen. And just like, you know, yeah. you and I turned around on Denali 2 years ago because we didn't want those types of things. Our toes yeah. and our fingers are more invaluable than taking the top. And that's what has, you know, you have to be disciplined if you want to play in this game.
Absolutely. You know, you bring up Denali from a couple of years ago. There were people that were pushing up through that terrible weather when we were sitting at 14 and they were getting frostbite. And, you know, there are always people like that. There are people like that on Everest that probably shouldn't be there, or they're too gung-ho, or they're willing to sacrifice fingers and toes for the summit when they don't necessarily need to. And those are mostly the people that get into trouble and you hear about. And that's why everyone thinks Everest is so dangerous. And, you know, certainly Everest is dangerous, but you can mitigate a lot of those risks. And if you're, if you know what you're doing or you're with a reputable guide service, those risks are pretty low. And when you compare climbing Everest to 50 years ago compared to now, it's much, much safer. We've got an incredible infrastructure in place in terms of fixed lines, you know, the ice fall doctors. We've got communication devices like sat phones and radios. We've got incredible weather forecasting capabilities. So all those things add up to make it a much safer experience. So while Mount Everest will never be safe, it's much safer now than it ever has been in the past.
Yeah, that's great news for me since I'm going to be there in about 13 months, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I got to tell you, though, the one thing that is really frustrating to me, and as you know, I played in the NFL. I played on a major college football team in Washington, and it's just kind of like the cream of the crop rose to the top. And, you know, you end up playing with D1 or NFL caliber talent, and the guys who don't make the cut, don't make the grade, they're out. They don't play. Yeah. They don't make the team, whatever it is. And when you take a person like myself, who I'm not a professional guide, and I rely on your expertise and your experience over all these different mountains you've climbed to help me get up and down safely, I know because I know what I do when I train. I know my power. I know my strengths. I'm also mixing and putting my life on the same rope team of other people I've never climbed with before. I don't have the luxury of saying, hey, Mike and Ed Viesters and some other guys I know, let's go climb this mountain. I'm not in that level. I'm not that place in life. And so just like what we had 2 years ago, where we had this Taiwanese guy that, you know, you guys do the best that you can to sort through and just, and try to evaluate whether or not people can be on the mountain. You know, we end up with somebody who's not helping, that lays down on the mountain, that becomes very dangerous, not only for himself, but for everybody else.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a great point. And it's most apparent on Mount Everest. You know, pretty much anyone that wants to sign up for an Everest climb can sign up, and the reputable companies won't take just anyone. They want to see you have a resume in place, and they want to make sure you're successful. But if you hire on with a cheap Nepali company or something like that, then they'll take you. They'll cash that check, and those are a lot of the people that are getting into trouble on Mount Everest. And, you know, it's tough to put it in the hands of the Nepalese government, because we do see quite a bit of corruption there. But it kind of seems like the Nepalese government needs to put some controls in place, like people need to have a certain resume or, you know, something along those lines. It seems like people need to be regulated a little bit more based on skill before they can just jump on Mount Everest, because those are the people that year after year end up getting into trouble. And that's why Mount Everest has the reputation that it does have. And, you know, it's pretty unfortunate. It's tragic. I remember last time I summited, 2016, on summit day, there was a team, an Indian team, that were obviously unprepared. I remember seeing them throughout the course of the expedition, and they all had the same matching gear on they had bought just before the climb. Obviously, an Indian guide service had brought them along and maybe painted it like a Kilimanjaro climb. And everyone knew that they were ill-prepared. And sure enough, on summit day, three of these climbers ended up dying. And it's tragic to see that. And yeah, I think if the guide companies took more of the burden on themselves to filter out people based on their resume and not just cash any check, and also maybe the government regulating things a bit more, we wouldn't see things like that. And Mount Everest would be a much safer place.
So when you peel it back a little bit and you start talking about all these mountains, your new company, Climbing the Seven Summits, offers around the world, what is your filter?
Well, certainly for something like Mount Everest, you know, generally I don't take a client for Mount Everest that I haven't climbed with in the past. I like to know, you know, their climbing resume and who they are in the mountains. And, you know, if someone has a really long climbing resume, then I might take them without knowing them. But, you know, in general, I just want people to be successful. So I want to see people have a progression of mountains. Obviously, I don't want to see someone sign up for Aconcagua that hasn't climbed at altitude before. They haven't been to Elbrus or Kilimanjaro. I think, you know, there needs to be a proper progression, and that means getting some skills training down low, doing Kilimanjaro, doing an Elbrus first, and then working your way up through the Denalis, the Aconcaguas, and then thinking about Choyu and Mount Everest. So, you know, that's kind of my philosophy, and it's worked really well. I, you know, as you mentioned, we had 100% success on Everest on my first year. And I think a lot of that is because I had climbed with everyone on the team. I knew their capabilities. I knew their strengths and weaknesses. And I was able to work towards that to make sure they were successful.
So are you, sticking on Everest, are you now in a position where you're going to Everest and you've got your infrastructure in place? So now you're the main guy in the tent and, you know, preparing what the day is going to look like. And then you're assigning guys to various Sherpa, and then they're going up the mountain. You're staying more at base camp and really monitoring the weather, the diet, you know, what's going on, when are you guys going to go, who's strong, who's weak. Is that kind of more your role now?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm less on the mountain these days. I'm more coaching from base camp and, kind of overseeing the entire expedition as expedition leader. So I'm dealing with logistics, weather, personalities, making sure everyone's taken care of, making sure the Sherpa are where they need to be, the climbers are where they need to be. So I'm kind of the one person at base camp overseeing the entire expedition and then hiring other guides and Sherpa to go up the mountain and take care of things up there for me. And, you know, obviously I'm in touch with everyone on the mountain via radio, but my job and where I'm most effective is being at base camp and kind of moving the chess pieces from there.
Yeah, got it. So, again, you're climbing the seven summits, new adventure outfitting, all to do with climbing mountains throughout the world. How many different expeditions, climbs, whatever you want to call this, do you offer now to people who want to climb with you?
We've got, I think, 10 or 12 expeditions offered on the website now. Obviously, you know, you consider my name, Climbing the Seven Summits. That's my focus. I focus on the tallest peak on each continent, the seven summits. But we also offer expeditions to Choyu, Mexico, Ecuador, some treks like Everest Base Camp treks, Machu Picchu, Torres del Paine in Patagonia. And, you know, I definitely want to keep my focus on the seven summits, but we've got a wide variety of offerings, basically covering the great mountains throughout the world.
Well, if you need a personal guide to work for you on Bora in Idaho, highest mountain, I'm your guy. All right.
There we go. Yeah, I'll keep in touch.
Hey, so tell me one, as I kind of wrap this up, I want to ask you about Choyu. It's in the Himalaya. It might be the 14th highest mountain in the world. And I know you and I have talked about myself going and taking that on. And it's kind of a, you know, the next step before you take on Everest. But tell me why that mountain is special to you.
Choyu is pretty special to me because it was my first 8,000 meter peak. It was the first big climb I did in the Himalayas. And, for me, it was just a paradigm shift. You know, I showed up on this Choyu expedition. I was 24-year-old kid, and I remember standing on the Tibetan plateau, looking up at Choyu, and a tear kind of came to my eye. It was so intimidating to look at this peak at nearly 27,000 feet, the world's sixth tallest mountain. And, you know, I didn't know what I had gotten myself into. And luckily, everything went smoothly. I climbed well and was able to stand on top. But it being my first really big mountain, first Himalayan 8,000 meter peak, it's always held a special place in my heart. And I've led 11 expeditions there now. I've actually summited that peak more than any other non-Sherpa. And I love getting back there every year. I love the cultural aspect of that. But, you know, I think the special thing about Choyu is that it's a perfect stepping stone for Everest. If people want to see how their body does at 8,000 meters and get to know the Sherpa and use the oxygen systems, I think that's the best training you can get for Mount Everest. And I think that's why it's so popular. You know, people want to, it's a much cheaper way to see how you do at altitude before committing to Everest. And success on Everest goes way up amongst people that have trained on Choyu.
Yeah, no, that's great. I would love to do that mountain, by the way. So I've got Vincent in my sights, as you know, coming up in January. And,
yeah,
the only reason why I'm not going with you is timing, and that's it. So we can start planning our Everest expedition, and I've got a whole roster trying to work on an NFL deal, NFL Networks, that
awesome.
Hopefully might be filming with us. So we need to stay in close contact on that, on how
Absolutely.
That might, that whole thing is going to shape up. The last question for you is this, is that I know that it's been kind of knee deep in your mind now for a couple of years about, you know, taking the risk and kind of jumping off the cliff with both feet in terms of starting this new company. Right.
Yep.
And so you've always had the security of being one of the top guides for IMG. And you didn't have to really carry the infrastructure of everything else that's going on. And you finally took the jump, the leap. And what has been the most satisfying thing at the end of the day as you've gone through your logo and planning this thing and designing your website and all the things you have to do to just create the foundation? What's been the thing that has given you the most satisfaction and joy to date?
I think just creating a company in my image, you know, this is my baby. And as you mentioned, you know, I always had that security of working for someone else. And it is scary to make that leap and do your own thing. As being a small business owner is not easy, but to be able to craft a company in your image is just so powerful. I've got passion back for what I'm doing for mountain climbing. And I think I was starting to lose that a little bit just going through this continuous cycle of climbing peaks for someone else. Now that it's my baby and everything I do benefits me, it's really powerful. And at the end of the day, that's been the best thing for me is just, you know, I pour so much more kind of love into these trips and my clients and communicating with clients just because it's my baby. It's what I love to do. And I've kind of found that passion again.
That's awesome. That's what life is all about. And it's just so many people, I mean, I'm metaphorically speaking now are, you know, they always want to go off. They want to do their own thing, but it's really putting those 10 toes on the cliff and jumping. I don't mean literally, of course, but you know, just taking that risk and just know that things are going to work out. And with you, I think, more than probably anybody I know, it's really where preparation met opportunity. So, you know, for 20 plus years, you have been doing this, you honed your game, you knew all these other guides from these various countries, you knew where to go. Like you literally had this thing down, and now it was just the time to like go, and you did. And, you know, I'm so happy for you, and you're a good dude, and you deserve all the success, you know, coming forward. And the great thing about all this is that for you, it's just only beginning, and you've got such a so many great things ahead of you that I'm excited about, and will continue to follow you and climb with you. And I really appreciate you being on the pod today.
Yeah, appreciate it, Mark. Good to connect with you.
You know, always awesome to get caught up, and look forward to catching you on Everest when we go do that mountain, okay?
Awesome. Sounds good. Thanks for having me on.
You got it.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, NFL.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.